You have your home in the city, it is true, and you have decorated it with trinkets and pictures and books, but you have a wife and a maid and hundreds of expenses. In waking, in sleeping, you must struggle with things, and you never have peace. I have peace. Keep your spiritual goods in the books and arts and newspapers. Keep your coffee houses and your whiskey, which always makes me sick. Here I can roam about the woods and I feel fine. If you put intellectual problems to me and try to drive me into a corner, I merely reply that God is the source and that men are in truth only specks and threats in the universe. Even you have gone no further. Footnote 5, text. Page 324. The motive of peace is rare in Hamsun's writing. Footnote 6, text. Its use here as the key to the blessings of rustic life could perhaps be interpreted as a legitimate protest against urban conditions. When, however, a protest in the name of seemingly higher ideas becomes a wholesale condemnation of civilization, when it does not discriminate between marketplace manipulation and family life, between the newspaper and artistic creations, between anxious restlessness and emotional pleasure, between the futility of mere distraction and the earnestness of serious readings, all of which Hamsun spurns with equal rancor, then we are not dealing with alert social criticism, but with anti-intellectual resentment. Hamsun, in the same breath, ridicules the cheap pictures on the wall and jeers at the intellect. The final outcome of such impotent resentment is the surrender to brute power. But first we must trace the steps of this process. What did Hamsun's heroes seek, and what did they find in their flight to nature? Solitude. When Hamsun speaks of man's solitude in nature, he seems at first glance merely to advocate liberation from the pressures of society. And there is another thing with which I am never finished, namely retreating and sitting in the solitude of the woods surrounded by beauty and darkness. This is the final joy. Footnote 7, text. Nature appears to hold forth the promise of fulfilling the desire for relationship in which gratitude, joy, and rest can come to fruition. Thanks to the lonely night, for the hills, the rush of the darkness and the sea through my heart. Thanks for my life, for my breath, for the boon of being alive tonight. Thanks from my heart for these. By my immortal soul, I am full of thanks that it is I who am sitting here. Footnote 8, text. But on closer inspection, it becomes clear that a new approach is in the making, according to which nature is more than a soothing balm. You must not believe that nothing happens here. I could send significant tales from here, but I don't do it. I have thought the woods for solitude and for the sake of my great irons. I have a few great irons with me, and they are getting red hot. Footnote 9, text. These passages do not conjure up an idyllic and peaceful image of nature, but introduce a note of boastful resentment. Page 325. A few pages later in the novel, the hero, thinking of the reindeer, ponders the secret of his existence. I think all these things, and you, have you compared your two newspapers, and do you know now that is the public opinion in Norway today about old age insurance? Footnote 10, text. Hamsun anticipates his imaged antagonist's retort and with considerable resentment. Here you will certainly help yourself and make sport of me. You can say many droll things about the tree stump and me, but deep down you know that I'm superior to you in this as in everything else. Once I admit that I do not have as much city knowledge and that I was no student, ha ha, you can teach me nothing about wood and fields, for there I feel what no man has felt. Footnote 11, text. The idea of a private kingdom to which man stubbornly clings, we have only to think of the dreams of fulfillment with which Ibsen endows his women, is transferred by Hamsun to the solitude of nature. This nature, however, is not merely an extra-human place where one can go and from which one can return. It is a substitute for human society. Nature is the seed of magical qualities of a new kind. In the old fairy tales, men learn to speak the language of animals in order to be lord of all creation. They seek to overcome the barriers of nature by bringing the animal world into the human through the medium of speech. Hamsun's hero, however, seeks to draw from nature the meaning which he can no longer deduce from history. What he overhears, the tales he could tell but does not. It not meant to increase man's knowledge of his world and himself. If the tales were told, they would report only his own resentment and contempt. Identity. The philosophy of liberalism did not encompass the idea that the whole world had come within man's power. Subject and object were opposed in the form of active man and conquerable nature. Nature was raw material in a man, the unrealized potential. Man realized himself in its conquest. Social relationships were implicit in this interaction. The knowledge of nature was won through communication of a man with man, and nature was transformed by organized societal enterprise. Page 326. The relationship toward which Hamsun's ideas tend is of a total different kind. Nature is no longer looked upon as an object for scientific and practical control. Instead, Hamsun's hero consecrates his life in rapt surrender to nature and even in mystical identification. We are in the midst of an omnipresence that is truly God, that is truly we ourselves as part of the whole. Footnote 12, text. To Hamsun's, nature means peace, but a peace which has lost its spontaneity and its will to know and to control. It is a peace based on submission to every arbitrary power, a pantheism which offers an escape from the gloomy framework of history. Nature comes to mean the solace of the unchangeable and the all-pervasive. He lost himself, was carried away and wrapped in the frenzy of sunshine. He was in a mysterious state, filled with psychic pleasure. Every nerve in him was awake. He had music in his blood, felt akin to all nature, to the sun and the mountains and everything else, felt surrounded by a whisper of his own ego sense from trees and tufts and blades of grass. Footnote 13, text. The hero avoids asking any embarrassing question about the rest of mankind. He shows concern only for his own fate. Here is even a hint that nature is his private property and that his enjoyment of it is a kind of personal possession. Paragraph after paragraph of exalted description communicates neither observation nor knowledge, but only a desire for personal omnipotence and for pantheistic possession of the world by emotional immersion. The sky, all open and clean, I start into that clear sea, and it seems as if I were lying face to face with the uttermost depth of the world, my heart beating tensely against it, and at home there. Footnote 14, text. The timelessness of such pantheism gives the illusion of an immediate, complete possession of the entire world, a possession that at the same time cuts off historical progress. Gone is the optimistic dualism of liberalistic philosophy, which always maintained close contact with history, considered the transitoriness of the human situation, and often gave birth to a conception of the future utopian, to be sure, in which a final stasis of perfection might be reached. Hamsun's identification with the whole of nature can be consummated with no exertion and with no fear of disillusionment. Page 327. What the utopians have envisioned as a potential unity of man and nature comes to be proclaimed as already realized. The meaning of man's life is to be found in natural factors such as blood and soil. When such a myth is consciously used in the interest of a power apparatus, as it was under fascism, men are told that their inevitable and irrevocable share of nature is their race and their nation. Fury. The shift to an authoritarian concept of nature is apparent also in the changed imagery of the fury of the elements. Compare Hamsun's description with similar ones in earlier literature. Hamsun writes, "Lightning flashes, and soon thereafter the thunder rolls like an immense avalanche far beyond, between the mountains, lightning again, and the thunder is closer at hand. It also begins to rain, a driving rain. The echo is very powerful. All nature is in an uproar, a chaos. I want to enfeeble the night by yelling at it. Otherwise, it will deprive me mysteriously of all my strength and willpower. More lightning and thunder and more driving rain. It is as if I were whipped by the echo nearby." Footnote 15, text. Kant, too, once wrote about the power of nature. "Bold, overhanging, and, as it were, threatening rocks, thunder-clouded, piled up to the vault of heaven, borne along with flashes and peals, volcanoes in all their violence of destruction, hurricanes leaving desolation in their track, the boundless ocean rising with rebellious force, the high waterfall of some mighty river." Footnote 16, text. At first sight, there appears to be no essential difference between the two passages. For Kant, however, the sublimity of nature and the experience of man's helplessness before it are counterbalanced by the concept of nature as subordinate in the face of humanity. It is man's own knowledge and imagination which creates the conception of the grandiosity in nature that dwarfs him. In the end, the rational faculties of man are of a higher order than the elemental force of nature, and they allow him to see it as sublime instead of simply terrifying. We readily call these objects sublime because they raise the forces of the soul above the height of vulgar commonplace and discover within us the power of resistance of quite another kind, which gives us courage to be able to measure ourselves against the seeming omnipotence of nature. Footnote 17, text.